Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name's John Bleasdale and today I am going to be talking to William J. Mann, the author of Bogey and Bacall, The Surprising True Story of Hollywood's Greatest Love Affair. It's an amazing book, rich in novelistic detail about one of the most iconic couples Hollywood has ever boasted, the Amber Heard and Johnny Depp of their day, you could say. We have a wide-ranging conversation, and I'm sure you're going to like it. Please remember to follow me on Twitter, Dr. Jonty, D-R-J-O-N-T-Y, and you can follow me on Threads with the same address, the same username, Dr. Jonty, D-R-J-O-N-T-Y, which is also my Instagram. And so it's all across the socials. You can do that. That would be wonderful. Remember to like, subscribe if you haven't already, and leave a review if you wish to encourage other people with similar interests to listen to the podcast. Before you do any of that, please enjoy the conversation. Bogart is my, he's definitely one of my heroes cinematically, I think. What was your first sort of entry into the world of Bogart and Bacall?
You know, I didn't approach this with a fan's eye. I'd seen, you know, The Maltese Falcon and Casablanca, of course, and liked Bogart, but I can't say that he was someone that I was jonesing to do a biography about. You know, I was more in the Cary Grant camp or the William Powell, someone like that. But when my editor suggested that I take on both Bogey and Bacall at the same time and kind of, you know, see their two stories in relation to each other, suddenly I became very intrigued by this man. And because, you know, what I found out was his screen persona was so very different from who he was personally and how he had grown up. And how did that persona emerge? And how much of it was truth? How much of it was fiction? And he became much more interesting to me. And consequently, he became a much more interesting actor to me. And I realized how really good he is. I mean, it's, you know, when you go back and you look at what he actually was doing there on the screen, of course, he makes it seem so effortless. And that was part of his his appeal, but he was really working at it. He was really doing some amazing work. And so he became much more fascinating to me.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those contradictions of, I often have friends who say, oh, I don't like looking at making of documentaries because it ruins the illusion. And I guess the same could be said to be true of biographies, that your job is kind of to deconstruct the very thing that we love.
Yes. And you have to do that understanding that, you know, we are dealing with some treasures here. We're dealing with icons, you know, illusions that people have. And my job, as I see it, isn't at all to dispel illusions as it is to understand those illusions and put them into context. I've always found the real story of whether they actors or of a film or a director, I found the real story is much more fascinating than the story that's sold. Sometimes there's, you know, there's truth to some of the stories that are told. I mean, I've also written about Elizabeth Taylor, who hewed very closely to her legend, but others did not. And to me, to do that, it's not an attempt to tear anything down, but to understand and I think make their stories even more interesting. If someone wants to read a book about, you know, the making of the Maltese Falcon or the African Queen, that's great and that's wonderful. My interest has always been about how did these movies and how did these actors get to where they are, and what did they tell us about the particular times they were living in, and what do they still tell us about who we are today? So that's really what I'm most interested when I'm doing a biography.
And Bogart, of course, comes some distance. You know, we see this tough guy persona, and I would always have pegged him as someone lower middle class, if not working class, as, you know, in terms of his upbringing or background, from the streets, you know, from the mean right. streets. And yet, of course, he comes from quite wealthy stock, quite good family. And you know, he's kind of, his first experiences of acting are sort of anyone for tennis. I mean, yeah, you say he never actually said that line, but it's that kind of role that he's doing.
Yeah, you know, and the studios wanted you to get that impression. They worked very hard to give that impression. But in the beginning, he was this handsome, debonair aristocrat who was cast in those roles. He was often the guy who woos the girl and then dumps the girl. He was the cad. Then he started playing these kind of Latin lovers, which, because he was so dark, you know, he had this role, and the women loved him. He was a Valentino on the stage in his very earliest years, and that the studio did a lot to try to distance from, because that was not going to sell with the Humphrey Bogart gangster image of the 1930s.
And his family, of course, were sort of like, you make the point that they're quite cold. You can't remember whether he was particularly hugged or by his mother, particularly. I don't want to get too Freudian on your ass, but that seems to, you know what I mean? There seems to be a feeling that that's where his emotional insecurity might be coming from as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you can't avoid that. I mean, I've encountered this with other people I've written about, Katharine Hepburn, John Schlesinger, people who grew up in upper class, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant families in that period, almost all were treated at a distance from their parents. They were raised often more directly by nannies and nurses and governesses. There was a sense in that culture, in that WASP upper class culture, that to encourage your children too much, to praise them, was to make them soft. You know, it was a it happens too often in these stories for me not to take that into account, because Bogart himself wrote about that. He wrote very frankly about how, you know, he grew up with, you know, the closest he ever got was maybe a clap on the back of his shoulder, you know, on a birthday or something like that. And it was very cold. very withdrawing, and then Bogart, because he wasn't performing in the way that young men of his class were supposed to perform, not only was he getting the distance and the lack of affection, he was getting the, you know, the actual disapproval of his parents and the condemnation of his parents. So that imprinted him and was with him for the rest of his life.
The toughness that will come later and will become part of his persona, encouraged by the studio department, there was an element of that of truth in that, in terms of the violence and in terms of the fact that he was always a bit of a rowdy, even though he was an upper class rowdy rather than a sort of dock fighter or something. But that starts off pretty early on.
Yes, you know, oftentimes when you're told that you don't measure up, you know, you can either accept that or you can fight back against it. And at various times, Bogey accepted it. At times he would fight back and say, you know, well, the hell with you. And he'd swing a punch. You know, he was also small. I mean, he only stood about 5'7", and, you know, he was thin, had sloping shoulders. And often guys who are built that way, you know, they become pugnacious because they have to be. And, you know, so he had a lot of chips on his shoulder, and he began to drink early. So the alcohol spurred that temper, that rage. So, yeah, he did have that fighting spirit. That's true with his characters, kind of a smoldering anger that could come through. So that part of the image was based in reality.
And you know, you're very forthright in your sort of assessment of him as an alcoholic as well, which is something that, having read previous biographies, tends to get sort of soft-soaked a little bit more and characterized as, you know, he's hard-drinking, rat packer, you know, and you're like, no, he's an alcoholic.
He was an alcoholic, and yeah. And it defined his life in so many ways. And I think it's you know, a great example of comparing him with his third wife, Mayo Metho, who was also an alcoholic, but she's always portrayed as the problem. You know, she's always played as the one who would get out of control when she drank. You know, Bogey was a good old guy. You know, good old guys are supposed to drink. Women are not supposed to drink. And yet so many times his drinking threatened his career, threatened, you know, there's the example, one of the last times, you know, when he was called into court because the woman accused him of shoving her. And, you know, many, many times his career almost ended because of his alcoholism.
And he never, and this is something you point out in the book as well, you know, these were different times. There weren't interventions. There weren't wasn't a rehab. There wasn't a culture of even talking about this or even naming it, you know, properly. There are so many points in this book where I'm thinking about, you know, how this wouldn't happen today, or it would certainly have a different ending if it happened today. Yeah. And he would not be considered this beloved star that he's come down through the ages to us. So again, that I think that's interesting. Reading the book is you really get a feel for the Hollywood of the times as well. This isn't just about Bogart and Bacall. It's also about what Hollywood is like at that time.
Yeah, it was part of the culture for men to drink and to act like that. You know, if you didn't, you were seen as maybe being a little too prissy, or, you know, Clark Gable drank, Spencer Tracy drank. It was to be expected. Yet at the same time, when he didn't show up for work and the bosses were getting uncomfortable with the fact that he wasn't coming in, or, you know, he was getting into fights on the set, this happened. And he was, to the public, the drinking was used almost as a way of bolstering his macho star credentials. But behind the scenes in the studios, they were getting increasingly concerned with what was going on.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many great stories in there. I mean, there's one that crosses over here, which was really, I don't want to spoil your book too much because people should go and read it and get these stories. But it's so rich in anecdotes, I'm sure I won't be able to. There's where sort of a journalist comes around to his house and he goes to answer the door. And then he goes back and gets a drink because he should have a drink in his hand when he answers the door, because otherwise the journalist won't see the Bogart that he's expecting.
Yeah, I love that story. That's a great story. I thought that epitomized exactly what was going on here. It was a period when it was later in his life, and he was, you know, thanks to Bacall, he was limiting his alcohol consumption, but it was now so much a part of his persona that Humphrey Bogart, who answers the door without a drink in hand, people would say, "What's wrong here?" And in fact, there were stories like that in the 1950s, the early 1950s, like, "What's wrong with Humphrey Bogart? He wasn't drunk when we saw him last time," you know.
Yeah, drinking and smoking constantly. I always think, like, as a side note, I always wonder what those Hollywood people smelled like, because I mean, before the smoking ban came in the UK in public places, I used to go to pubs and your clothes would reek. Oh, yeah. And everything would reek, you know.
You'd wake up the next morning and it would smell like you were still in the club. I mean, it was your clothes, it hung on you. Yeah, it absolutely was. And yet it was seen as glamorous. I think the idea of, you know, smoke hanging in throughout a room or even on someone's breath was seen as kind of glamorous and edgy and exciting.
And I guess if everybody's smoking, nobody cares. It's just like everything, right. It just smells like air after a while.
Exactly.
And you mentioned his third wife, who I remember meeting her via David Niven's The Moon is a Balloon, in which he has a very funny section about Bogart and Bacall and the battling Bogarts. That's what they sort of become known as. And yes. I think what you write is a really interesting corrective in saying, hey, she was not the, you know, she wasn't the baddie here, you know.
Right. Or if she was the baddie, there was another baddie involved too. You know, they egged each other on, and he was equally as culpable for the failure of that marriage, if not more, because in fact, at the time they married, Bogart was still under the impression that, you know, his wife should put her career second to his, which Mayo did. She was very happy. I mean, given the fact that her career was also in the tank at the time, she didn't really have much choice, but, you know, she did, and she really became a huge booster for him. And, you know, their drinking became legendary, but it wasn't as if the stories are always positioned as she's the one assaulting him. When I interviewed some people, they said, you know what, he was swinging at her too at times, and that's sad to say, but that was the fact. It was there's an awful lot of misogyny in Bogart's story, and especially true when it comes to Mayo Metho, that she somehow was this monster. John Huston took joy in humiliating her in his memoir. After a while, it just began to become very cringy. And I do hope I've provided some form of a corrective there.
I mean, Huston's autobiography, An Open Book, he's got form. There's kind of a litany of misogynistic portraits. And I love John Huston as a director.
Oh, he's absolutely.
And a wonderful actor as well, Chinatown, obviously. His vision of women was unreconstructed, which, in other words, just bigoted.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and Howard Hawks, the same thing. I mean, it's these directors who today probably would have been called out by the Me Too movement, and rightfully so. And yet you can't take away from the fact that their work, you know, it's brilliant. But I also think we have to understand who these people were at the same time.
Yeah, I think we've got to get rid of the dichotomy of, like, cancellation, which I don't think even necessarily exists as much as people worry about. I mean, I come from a literature background, so I'm kind of used to reading anti-Semites and racists.
Yeah.
And
you can't avoid it when you're a historian or a literary historian or a social historian. It was there. Racism, sexism, homophobia, that was part of the culture, and it's there. And I think rather than try to cancel the people, cancel John Huston, for example, show the films, but then talk about who he was. Mm-hmm. And where do we see this in their work if we do? And I think, yeah, absolutely, we need to tell the full story, which is what I do with my work. I tell the full story rather than trying to tear anybody down. I just say, hey, here's the reality. Here are the facts. Now let's take a look at their work and their life and make sense of it.
Yeah, I think it's interesting as well because I have so much admiration for Bogart as an actor. And there's a legend, and also sort of politically, I feel there are moments where I really align with him. But you've got to get away from these buts. You've got to start using ands as a conjunction. You know, it's got to be like, sure, you know, he was an alcoholic and violent and a Democrat and a great actor. Not but as if there's some sort of like we're making some sort of equation. It was just. These were all part of the same thing. Let's move on a little bit to Betty Bacall because one thing about I know less about Betty Bacall because obviously I've nailed my colors to the mast as a bogey fan. I hesitate to use the word fan because it's that's definitely, I'm going to have to mea culpa that one. But with Betty Bacall, one thing came out at me was the fact that she was Jewish and the fact that her Jewishness had to be suppressed and had to be sort of written out of the picture. And the fact that I'm a big fan of Bogart and therefore I know about Bacall quite a bit. And that wasn't a thing that sort of sprang to mind instantly, that came as a little bit of a surprise, a kind of like, oh, maybe I did know that, but, you know, it wasn't fully present. It shows how successful that sort of realignment has been.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was astounding to go back and see how deliberate that was, and also see her discomfort with that and her family's discomfort with that. You know, her ambition at that point, she was probably willing to do whatever the studio told her, write out my family, change my name. But at the same time, she did have some conflict with that and some personal struggles with that, but in fact, you know, she was deliberately cast as something she was not. Howard Hawks, who she was under personal contract with, did not even know she was Jewish when she first signed her, and she was terrified of what he might say when he found out, because he was very open with his anti-Semitism. He would make, you know, anti-Semitic jokes all the time, and she would cringe and she would sit there and say, what do I do? Do I ruin my career? Do I stand up for myself? In the midst of all this, her grandmother died, who was an immigrant from Romania. And I think her death really bothered her because she felt she was selling out her grandmother, who she loved very much. And later in her life, Bacall did make a point to speak to various Jewish organizations. In her memoir, talked about being Jewish. So it was almost a relief for her at that point, like saying, "Okay, you know, I was forced to keep this quiet for so long, and now I'm gonna shout it to the world because that's who I am."
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it comes as a moment which is really interesting, I think, where she has started a relationship with Bogart, and she says to him, I've got something to tell you. And she tells him she's Jewish, and he's like, that's fine. You know, what's the problem? And it's kind of like, oh, great. There's the bogey I love.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, Bogey really didn't have, a lot of prejudices, and those that he did, he worked through them in the course of his life. You know, he was, I came away with a great deal of admiration for him about his relationship with the world, because he grew, and I think Bacall was a big part of that. And he was, he was a misogynist, or at least a sexist, in the early parts of his life, and treated his wives with a degree of chauvinism for certain. But by the end of his life, you know, he was proud of Bacall, and he started to understand that women could play an equal role in his life, in society. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact when he and Bacall went to Washington, as you reference, in 1947 to speak out against the House Un-American Activities Committee, you know, there were an equal number of women with them as there were men. And I think he saw himself standing shoulder to shoulder now with women and actually making a difference.
Absolutely. Then that is a moment which we let's come back to that in a second, because I want to go back a little bit to Betty Bacall, who sort of becomes Lauren Bacall as a result of Howard Hawks. He renames right. her. But the other thing that strikes me is how young she is, and that's something you underline, that she's going through all these really difficult phases, having to negotiate, you know, dangerous men who have records, are on the record with being quite predatorial in their hunt for young women and sex, and she has to negotiate all of that, and it's really the unlikeliness of it really comes out in the book.
Yeah, she became brilliant in how to deal with predatory men, and I think that was largely because she had a lot of experience with that in New York. She was this ambitious young woman, very pretty, very statuesque, who figured out, okay, I can get this audition because this man finds me attractive, but now how do I keep it at this level of professionalism and not let it go any farther? And I really think she was successful with that because she kept her boundaries. And I think there were times when, you know, reading between the lines in her memoir, where she might have been able to get a little something more, but she suddenly withdraws from a project or writes, I didn't get it. And I think she realized, I'm not going to go in that direction. I'm going to, you know, step back. And she tells that funny story of Walter Pigeon, you know, trying to corner her in a hotel room and how she kept it at bay and got out of there. So she knew how to do it. But at the same time, Hollywood was much more difficult. She was very young. And she was very ambitious, and she was scared. She confided to friends that she was scared of. Not only was she scared of Hawks finding out that she was Jewish, but she was scared that he would put the move on her. And she was encouraged at times to go spend some alone time with him in his office, and she never did that. And part of the reason I think she hooked on to Bogey so quickly during the making of To Have and Have Not was because, okay, I'm safe here. This guy is not going to make a move on me. He eventually gives her a kiss, but she knew that he was not predatory in that way. That was another thing about Bogey that really came through, is that he was not someone who made passes at his leading ladies. He you know, there was never any kind of unwanted sexual advances on women that he worked with or on the set. Tended to be faithful to his wives for the most part. So she felt safe with him.
Yeah, and he's sort of like, you describe him as a kind of romantic, in that he's, you know, he really wants to go home to you know, I mean, when he does go home, when he's not out on a bender, he wants to have that one relationship, that he's really in love with someone. Rather than, you know, a series of flings. She even describes that kiss from in her memoir as not being a lunge, being sort of a sort of tentative sort of romantic kiss. So they come together on To Have and Have Not, which like many of these films which come up, it's always really funny to read how films that we now regard as classics were at the time of their making and conception were often seen as far less than what they would become. You know, Casablanca is one of the best examples, where they're in the commissary saying, you know, what is this piece of shit? It's not got an ending. To Have and Have Not was kind of seen as sort of like, oh, this is another chance to cash in on Casablanca.
Absolutely. It's so, you know, you can see the imprint of Casablanca all throughout. I mean, this is just another reworking of the Casablanca formula. And the film itself isn't that great, but it's made wonderful. It's made so watchable, so much fun, so exciting because of this chemistry between Bogey and Bacall. And everybody else is good in it. The actors are good. The atmosphere is good. But the story itself is pretty thin. I don't think there was a big sense that this was going to be a great classic at the time. But Bogart and Bacall, they just brought that extra charisma, and it's so much fun. I just showed it to a group of people who'd never seen it before, and they're like, this was wonderful. You know, it's crackling. And I think, you know, one of the great things about To Have and Have Not is that it's a rare case where the moment Steve and Slim fall in love on the screen is the exact same moment Bogart and Bacall fall in love in life. You know, that's really happening there, right there on the screen.
Absolutely. And that scene wasn't that like her rehearsal scene as well, or her audition?
Yeah. Wasn't supposed to be in the film. It was a little bit of dialogue that they gave Bacall for one of her rehearsals or screen tests. And they liked it so much, they said, put it in the film. Because it actually doesn't really make sense narrative-wise. Why is she suddenly, you know, they've just met. Why is she suddenly asking him to whistle? But it works so perfectly, and it's just so much fun to watch. Every time I watch it, I get chills.
I think Casablanca is always going to be a favorite of mine because it's, you know, it's just got everything. It's got absolutely everything, and to Have and Have Not has, you know, so many elements which are obviously sort of not quite as good copies. So the piano player is not as good as, you know, as in Casablanca. But that word fun runs all the way through the film. And at no other film have I ever seen. I remember watching it for the first time at a friend's house on a videotape, which is how long ago it was. And I remember seeing the end where she walks across the bar and she just does a little shimmy and it ends there. And it's like, there's nothing in the film that says the film should end there. It's like the plot hasn't ended. There's been no sort of violent thing and it's just that shimmy is so good. It's like they go, that's it. That's the end of the movie. You know?
Absolutely. She's, you know, there's a moment also in the film where, you know, she's so sultry, you know, she does sultry so well. But there's one moment in the film, I think I actually write about it in the book, where she smiles. And you just see the joy that's beneath that sultriness. You see the youth, the almost innocence. And, you know, she's never really better than she was in To Have and Have Not. She's just so raw and so natural that it's no wonder it was such a smash, and no wonder that her reviews were stratospheric at that point.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, she goes and does another film, which is like The Confidential Agent, I think it's called.
Yeah,
and you talk about it being like treated as a comedy, and it's not a comedy, but everybody's just laughing at the screen.
Yeah, it was a very fast reversal of fortune. So it was good that The Big Sleep came along when it did.
Mm. And The Big Sleep, another magnificent film, and another Howard Hawks film, which is much.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
More fun than it is well plotted, shall we say.
Exactly.
You know, the Raymond Chandler, William Faulkner is writing on both of the films, I think.
Both of them, or parts of them, yeah.
And you talk about him writing sort of like sheets of dialogue and them going, we can't, you know, this isn't a film. It's a monologue.
Yeah, this is not a novel. But Hawks wanted Faulkner because, yes, there were too many words, but that's what he wanted the characters to say. So let's boil that down and find a way to say that, but exactly the point he's making. Yeah. And I agree. The Big Sleep is another one of those films that is just so watchable, so much fun. The interactions between the characters, the set design, the lighting. But yeah, the plot, sometimes I had to sit there and say, well, exactly what's happening right now? But who cares? Because it's so much fun.
Absolutely. I mean, there's this famous story about William Faulkner phoning up Raymond Chandler and saying, who killed so-and-so? And Chandler didn't know either. And he'd written
he didn't know either. Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
But I mean, I love because the film does exactly what it needs to do. You don't need to have that plot being sort of bulletproof. It's about things like Bogart getting in off the rain from the rain with the in the bookstore. But
yes, with Dorothy Malone.
Exactly. Yes.
Yes. She's
what a scene.
Yeah, what a scene. And you know, let's pull the blinds down. You know, it's so evocative. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's a birth of a Hollywood cliche. That must be one of the first times you've had that sort of taking the glasses off the girl and suddenly realizing she's pretty. Totally.
Yeah, right. Yeah, she was a knockout. Right, exactly.
I love that film. It's such a wonderful, it's kind of like, same with To Have and Have Not and a lot of Howard Hawks films. There's a sort of hangout quality to it where you're just enjoying hanging out with them.
Yes, absolutely. Bringing up Baby, the same thing. You know, even the slapstick, but you love these people. You just want to, you can't get enough of them.
So going at this point, they're sort of riding high with these movies, and they're doing really, really well. And it seems to be a partnership. The divorce is relatively easy. It's kind of surprisingly easy, even though Bogey feels guilty about the divorce and what it, you know, and his now ex-wife. But here comes the House of American Activities with its, Black Cloud and its moral quandaries. And this is the point where there is a another sort of reversal, in that they march off to Washington full of righteous fire, and then it's sort of, Bogart gets cold feet. Is that right? Is that how you saw it?
Partly, yes. I mean, there was certainly a lot of righteous fire, and they were, a group of actors and directors and writers, not politicians. They didn't think through how is this going to play in the media. They didn't have, the studio publicist saying, hey, this is probably not the best idea, or if you're going to do it this way. They just went off and did it. And I admire them for that. I mean, these were citizens, American citizens, who did not like what they saw happening, and they didn't see enough criticism of what was happening. And whether you agree with their point of view or not, they had every right to go there and say what they did, but they weren't prepared for a Washington press that was nothing like the Hollywood press, where the Hollywood press is all, in bed with the studios and the publicists are there. These were some hard bitten journalists who were very gleeful to try to take down these dilettantes, as they saw them, from Hollywood, who were coming to make some noise. So I don't think Bogey so much got cold feet. In fact, they left. They were still making radio statements even after that difficult reception from the media, but it was when the drumbeat continued. We see it today. We were talking about cancel culture. There was certainly a sense in that moment, you didn't have the term or even the concept, but there was a sense that Humphrey Bogart had to be punished. He could not get away with doing that. So you see the criticism just mounting and mounting and mounting. So finally he has to say, well, look, if there are communists among the Hollywood 10, well, they of course should be punished for that, or they should be singled out for that. But I went to, defend the cause, and every time he tried to defend their actions, he sounded more slippery and more trying to work his way out of it, to the point where eventually, of course, he pens that piece Ian Photoplay saying, I am no communist. Bacall did not want him to write it. His son has written about how Bogart regretted it the moment he did it. But, you know, such was the tension, such were the times. And, you know, the stakes were so very, very high at that particular moment. People were losing their jobs. People were going to jail. And so I think he felt he had no other choice.
Yeah, that's a real sense of, I mean, I think that's really well brought out in the book, that's a sense of just the amount of pressure that was put on. And also the pressure that added to Bogart's already exaggerated is necessarily fair, but insecurity. I mean, because he's always looking out over his shoulder. And again, as a viewer or as an audience member, you tend to think of Bogart as being this unassailable, somebody who doesn't think twice about his status or his position in the industry because he's this huge icon. But of course, he, even at the height of his success, he's turning around and thinking that William Holden's coming right through. And during the war, he's thinking, you know, Jimmy Stewart's off fighting and I'm here. And, you know, Clark Gable is almost as old as me, and he went and signed up. So there's all this simmering insecurity that in the background. And, you know, Bacall has a lot of, as you say, does a lot of good for him in bolstering him and helping him out. But even there must be some sense that, you know, there's a huge generation gap, and he's, you know, he's got this young wife that is he going to live up to his legend with her even?
Yes, there was an incredible fear that he was going to lose her to a younger man.
Yeah.
And you know, today we look at an age difference of, you know, she was 20 when they were married. He was 45. So that's a 25-year age gap. And, you know, we rightfully ask questions about it. You know, love knows no age. So I'm not trying to say that these relationships can't work, but they do come with challenges.
Mm.
And as Bacall and Bogart, as their marriage continued, and as she got into her early 20s and she's suddenly, you know, in the prime of her life, she's vital and she's exciting and she's still beautiful. And he's getting older and sicker and more frail. Yeah, he became very insecure about that. In fact, a number of people said that his greatest fear in that period was that he was going to lose her. And of course, there were moments where she was moving away from him sexually and or at least romantically, emotionally. We don't know if there was a sexual infidelity, but we do know that there was an emotional infidelity on both their parts, but mostly with her. And that was very, very frightening for him, the idea of losing her.
Mm. And the fact that he's got all these people around him who sort of admire him, like people like Frank Sinatra, who sort of is famously sort of has him as the I don't know, den leader of the right. Rat Pack and all that sort of stuff. And yet, oh God, I don't know if I'd want Frank Sinatra as an enemy or as a friend. I'm not sure which would be worse.
I agree. Yeah, he was a bit of a snake in the grass there, I think, especially towards the end. You know, Sinatra did admire Bogey, so that's why my gut tells me that the friendship with Bacall, while Bogey was still alive, remained that. But I think there was an incredible amount of flirtation nonetheless, and a lot of attention being paid back to each other. But I think, yeah, he was, he could be very unscrupulous, but at the same time, I think his admiration for Bogey would have kept that relationship platonic, at least while Bogey was alive.
Yeah, and I don't even want to speculate as to the time frame that he would consider respectful.
Right.
So you had the illness is a sort of tragic part of this story, because, you know, I mean, it's obviously like, you know, no shit Sherlock moment of the guy who smokes all the time dies of cancer, and it feels like there are a lot of I mean, there feels like there are a lot of parallels with other stars of that generation. You know, I think immediately of someone like Spencer Tracy as well, you know, another great love affair that you actually mentioned in the introduction as well as a sort of a possible competitor for the title of greatest Hollywood love affair.
Right.
It also feels tragic because it also feels like he's coming into his own as an actor even more, if anything.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. You look at the Caine Mutiny, right? I mean, it's just he's magnificent in that. And, you know, had he lived, I think he would have gone on to, because at that point he was more versatile than Gable, for example. I think he would have gone on to do some really interesting work in the 1960s, even into the 1970s. So yeah, his loss was really felt. And yet at the same time, I think his illness, in some ways provided the closure for so many things in his life, and in his marriage. So it's, you know, obviously he would have much preferred to live, I'm sure. And we would have much preferred to have him live. But I think during that illness, there was some sense of closure with some of those long-term issues that he'd been struggling with all his life.
And when you see him, I mean, one other film I just need to mention is as proof of his status as an actor, above and beyond creating the bogey image, if you like, is The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, which is a real step out. And I also want to mention at the other end of his career, right near the start of his career, certainly as a leading man, The Black Legion, which I think is a really underrated film, in which he definitely is not playing Humphrey Bogart. He's playing a character, you know.
Right. Well, I agree on Black Legion. It's phenomenal what he is able to do in that film. And I also think, you know, it's also a film that helped shape his political views, I believe. And he is creating a character that is, you know, goes from sympathetic to absolutely evil, complete evil, and yet he's so fascinating, so you know, you can't stop watching him. And the same thing is true with Sierra Madre, where he is so good in that film, and the fact that he dies, I think, you know, 25 minutes before the film ends, and he just kind of disappears, yet he still hangs over that film. I mean, it's his film from start to finish. As good as Walter Huston is, but at the same time, Bogart could be really scary on film, even in you know, some of his last films. He could be very scary because he, you know, Petrified Forest, he knew how to project evil, but with this kind of strange core of humanity underneath it all. And that's, I think, what makes his portrayal so compelling, because you're terrified, but at the same time, you recognize this person as being a human being. And perhaps that makes it even scarier.
Yeah, it's much more credible. You know, I even like his horror film. Yeah. I know he wasn't a fan of that.
It was
ridiculous, but I'll watch anything with him in, and indeed have. So then, following his death, you have sort of a difficult moment for Lauren Bacall, in the sense of, you know, she has a long, long afterlife. And it's interesting. I think you mentioned this near the beginning of the book as well, that, you know, even later on when she's getting her Oscar, she's burnishing this legend of her and Bogey, really to the detriment of kind of her own much longer life and her, you know, her children to some degree as well.
Right. Oh, absolutely. I think Bacall realized after Bogey's death that this was always going to be the defining aspect of her life. This relationship was going to be it. You know, there wasn't going to be a second relationship that, you know, she could find something with. And I think for a while she hoped that her career might bring her to a level where she was Bogey's equal, and that she could have done a career after his death. But in fact, you know, the disastrous relationship with Frank Sinatra, her falling out with many of her Hollywood friends. She flees Hollywood, goes first to London, then to New York, and tries to find herself, tries to find a new way forward. And she is somewhat successful in that. I mean, she does win 2 Tony Awards for Broadway, but I also think she realized that, okay, well, part of my legacy, part of my my persona is always going to be as one half of Bogey and Bacall. So why not take charge of that image, that legend, and make it exactly what I want it to be, because that's what I can leave behind. And she's very industrious at that. She works very hard at burnishing that legend. And as I've said in the book, you know, unlike many Hollywood legends, there's mostly truth in the Bogey and Bacall legend, you know, but she just makes sure all those little parts, it's a little too messy. She makes sure as those get burnished out.
Yeah. There's a real sad episode where her dog dies, I think. And she sort of thinks I've got to be with Bogey but he's out drinking with a pal. Right. And you know, as you say, it's very interesting that she doesn't leave that episode out, even as she's sort of skating over what is obviously a very cruel and traumatic moment for her.
Right. You know, and there were many moments like that. And she, you know, her memoir, at least her first one, is really an unusual Hollywood story, because she's very candid. And so much is said between the lines, and part of my job was to read her memoir and say, okay, what's she actually saying here? What's between these two lines, without reading into them, but, you know, it's understanding that she is telling us more than what's simply on the page. And not a lot of stars do that. It's all fluff but she really does try to tell the truth, but it's notable what parts she includes like that. So that's important. But it's also interesting when she doesn't include certain things, like the fact that her uncles did not come to their wedding. You know, it was something that clearly indicates that they were not happy with the marriage. And that's something that she needed to iron out of the legend.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And going on with her, I mean, how many marriages does she have afterwards? She marries Jason Robards.
Jason Robards.
And yeah, you know, she knows how to pick him. Nothing, a bloody alcoholic.
Right. And yes. Exactly. And partly, I think she thought, well, I've dealt with Bogey's alcoholism, I can deal with Jason's. But you know, Jason was, you know, an incredible actor, but he was never Humphrey Bogart. And so I think, you know, she found that this is not somebody that I can manage. And the relationship just was simply never that deep. He didn't want to get married. He didn't, you know, I don't want to say she tricked him, but you know, right from the start, he didn't want to get married, and yet he did. And they had a child, and he was not happy. Whereas Bogey was very happy to be married.
It's almost like, yeah, she was, I mean, even with, it's a little bit like in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, when, Steve McQueen watches Sharon Tate dancing with Roman Polanski and Jay Spearing and says, she's definitely got a type. It felt like that. Jason Robards and
absolutely type. Yeah.
Craggy faced. She definitely had a type. I love Lauren Bacall's sort of, you know, becoming this grand dame and becoming sort of, she has that wonderful cameo on The Sopranos when she, you know, and she seems to enjoy sort of playing with her role, even though she's also very much committed to, as you say, sort of retaining and burnishing that legend, a little bit like a band which is quite happy to play its greatest hits. It doesn't need to play any new material, you know?
That's a great analogy. Yes, I think so. And you know, she was very happy to talk about Bogey. And you know, one of the things that I realized not early on, I mean, and her son Stephen wrote about this in his book, and I talk about it. You know, she right from the start, it was all about Bogey. You know, her children actually came a distant second, and that made their relationship difficult all their lives. I mean, you know, both she was open about that. They've been open about that. Less so with her son, with Jason Robards, because it was a different dynamic. But Yeah, and I think for a moment after Bogey died, she tried to get away from that. I'm not going to make Bogey so central in my life anymore. Mm. But, you know, it was inevitable. She couldn't get away from it.
Mm, yeah, yeah. And it's, I mean, she was so, even when he died, she was still so young. She had still so much time to live. Yeah. But it's maybe fascinating to us as a, you know, drawing back a little bit and looking at this idea that you have as a sort of subtitle of your book, of this famous Hollywood love affair. I think we are fascinated by this crossover between real life and fiction, that this moment, I mean, we see you, another love affair that you mentioned, Richard Burton, Elizabeth Taylor, you know, the pleasure, sometimes the only pleasure in watching some of their films is in trying to trace, okay, are they arguing as the characters or are they arguing? You know, even their best, one of their best films together, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? You really are sitting there going, is this anger and spite in the play or is this just them?
You get a sense that this same exact scene has happened, you know, beyond the cameras.
They've been rehearsing this their whole lives.
Yes, all their lives.
Yeah. And the same is true of Bogey and Bacall, that you know, that similar, as you say, you know, that the moment we fall in love with them as characters and they fall in love as characters, they're falling in love with each other as real people.
That's right.
I'm wondering if that happens anymore. I mean, presumably, there's no reason it shouldn't, but it's almost as if we have become more squeamish about that sort of real life and movie life crossovers.
Yeah, you know, it's just people try to compare, you know, today to classic Hollywood, and it's becoming increasingly difficult to do that because the form has changed, and the way we watch moving images has changed. We don't really go into theaters anymore to watch them. They aren't 15 feet in size. They aren't, you know, gargantuan images in the dark. You know, they're on smaller screens in our living rooms and our, you know, on our computers and our phones. And it's really become much more, you know, it's too cliche to say the magic is lost, because there's always going to be magic in things, in stories that are told on the screen, and no matter what the size is. But there was a mystique, there was a mystery that existed up until probably the middle part of the 1980s, and then got less and less from there, and probably was beginning to get less and less from the end of the studio system in the 1960s. And so it's hard to know what's real and what's not, because so many of the actors and performers today, they retain their characters on their Instagram feeds, or they try to show you parts of their life. So that kind of all bleeds into their on-screen performances. You know, the very best actors, I think, do rise above this somewhat, you know, a Cate Blanchett or, you know, Meryl Streep or something. But at the same time, so many of the you know, actors, celebrities, performers today, I'm not sure the right word, you know, it's a 24/7 job now. You know, you're being you everywhere, no matter whether you're shooting a part or you're, you know, on social media or you're, it's much more difficult to be able to compare. It's almost like what we saw back then, what we saw at Bogey and Bacall, we'll never really see again. You know, we're going to see other wonderful things, but we're not going to see that anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. And the context is, as you say, the context is totally, I mean, if I think about real life love affairs, you're thinking, I don't know, Jennifer Lopez and Ben Affleck now, or Brangelina back in the day, you know, Kay, Pat, and Stu, I've forgotten how to say it now. Robert Pattinson and Kristen Stewart is what I'm, Kay Stewart and R. Pats, you know.
And many of those, like especially the Brangelina, were simply reruns of Elizabeth Taylor and Eddie Fisher and Debbie Reynolds, you know. I mean, it was, and they're marketed now, you know, in ways that weren't then, you know. Not to say that Bogart and Bacall weren't marketed. They definitely were.
Right.
But it was a, it wasn't a 24/7 idea. It was a sense that there was this mystery, and that we couldn't really penetrate what was going on behind that mystery, and nor did we expect to, nor did we even necessarily know there was a mystery. Now I think we presume there's a mystery all the time. We say, well, is this real? And you know, they want us to believe that it's real. It's a whole different ball game.
Yeah, I it's funny because I recently had experience of talking to Amber Heard, and the whole thing around that is just like, there would be so many classical Hollywood stars who would be undone by, you know, mobile phone technology, because that those scenes, as ugly as they might be, you know, were probably being played out millions of times in other kitchens and in other parts of Hollywood.
Right.
It's just that these guys are recording themselves rather stupidly.
Right. Yeah, but technology has changed our relationship with celebrity. It has changed our relationship with entertainment. The line between what is entertainment and what is not is very thin, you know, and it's why I say, and people say, oh, will you ever write a book that's about Hollywood in the, you know, 2000s or 2010s or something? I say, oh, absolutely not. Because it's a world I don't recognize. I can't imagine what I would possibly have to say.
Yeah, absolutely. That's another generation. There's a William Mann Jr. who can do that.
Yeah. You know, somebody, I don't know how people will do these books in the future, because, you know, people actually did this strange and rare thing back in the day where they actually wrote letters to each other, and, you know, and you got letters, and, you know, they're preserved in archives, and I can see what people were saying. You know, it doesn't exist anymore.
No, not the hard copy. Certainly not.
No hard copies.
Brilliant, William. Final question for our readers. I always love, for our readers. Well, they are readers because they're listening to a podcast called Writers on Film. So, of course, they're readers. So for our listeners and readers, could you recommend a film book? And the choice is absolutely open to you. Something that maybe influenced you or something you've just read and enjoyed.
Wow. Yeah, it's so many. I'm thinking...
Nobody just says one, by the way. Everybody cheats.
Gosh. Easy Rider's Raging Bull.
Peter Biskind, yes.
Peter Biskind. That's such an important book about the changeover to Hollywood. I mean, I also really love... This shows my interest in it. So that's my interest in the later Hollywood, but I'm also really interested in early Hollywood. So I love Kevin Brownlow's The Parade's Gone By. I think it's such an evocative piece on the silent era. Particular biographies that I've really liked. I think Scott Eyman's book on John Wayne was remarkable.
It's a great book.
John Wayne has never been a real favorite of mine, but I thought the book was really insightful and really interesting. And Pat McGilligan, I think anything that Patrick McGilligan has written, he's done a number of biographies, but he also did a really great series of interviews with screenwriters who had been blacklisted and really important books. So anything that Patrick McGilligan has written. And Janine Basinger's recent book on, and gosh, I'm forgetting the title, but it was on movie stars.
The Star Making Machine is
She did it with Sam Wasson.
It's called Hollywood and Oral History.
Hollywood and Oral History. That's it. Yes.
Because Sam Wasson came on to speak, and I need to get Janine Basinger on, because she's keeps saying I'll put you in touch with her so you can have
one of the greats. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, listen, William, thanks so much for a brilliant book. I loved reading about it. I loved the way these stories came together. It reads like a novel. It really does. And you have that, the thing I aspire to in my own writing, and that I love a book to do, which is, it really puts you there. You know, you have sort of you have the weather and what people, you know what I mean? You have the texture of the place as well as the events and the people, you know, and
I try to do that. Yes. Thank
yeah.
You.
It's a real novelistic feel to it. I love that. So thanks very much for coming and talking to me.
It's been delightful.
I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.